Have you ever had a feeling that something dreadful was about to happen?
This whole premise is sweaty.
Okay, moving right along.
You gonna plagiarize the whole thing for us? Do you have any thoughts of your own on this matter?
Just remember that this thing isn't as black as it appears.
Hold on to your butt.
The only difference between me and a homeless man is his job.
I'm glad you're here to tell us.
I'm looking for the least possible amount of responsibility.
And that ain't bad.
I'm in a glass case of emotion.
Man's got to know his limitations.
I'm glad you came back.
In the bag.
Network.
I drink it up.
Welcome to the Bag Pod, everyone. The second week of being back. We've got Joe Dog and Jimmy TV right now.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
And later, hopefully, we will be joined by one Mr. Alan Pierre for a little Mad Men talk and a discussion of what he's up to in the workplace, since he's an actor. That's actually interesting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing about what he's actually, about his jobs.
Yeah. I believe he's got a guest spot or something on some sort of television show, so we'll definitely talk to him about that. But, of course, the podcast has to open up with a little bit of Game of Thrones and maybe even a little bit movie talk at the end, if we can fit that in. But we had episode 2 of the season 3 of Game of Thrones this week. Lots of setup again for some of the lesser characters, if you will, some of the non-king characters not biding for kingship across the land. This episode kind of started to get into the more magical elements of the show, with Bran being met by Jojen in his dreams, and talking about him being a warg, and then of course we get the first instance of the Brotherhood, who have a magical element later on. I don't know.
That wasn't hinted at all, though, in this episode, was it?
No. I don't think it was hinted at in this episode. But apparently, I guess I didn't recognize Beric Dondarrion, but apparently he was in this episode.
Oh, for real?
I don't think he was.
That's what the IMDb said.
If he was in like the tavern. He definitely wasn't in the wilderness scene.
Yeah, but anyway, before we get to all that, how do you feel that the show translated the whole sort of like magical warg stuff from the book? Since, Bran's dreams and all that sort of stuff,
and then also Oral, wildling, warg. I liked it. I'm glad we did not get a hawk cam. That would have been terrible, I'm sure.
Yep.
Glad we were spared that.
Mm-hmm. Game of Thrones, up to this point, there hasn't really been that much of a hint. I mean, there's been, like, little hints of magic, I suppose, but nothing like...
No, there's been some major magic moments, but it's just always... It's never always part of the episode. I mean, it always kind of... happens at the very end of the seasons, with Daenerys doing her thing.
Yeah.
We had the random smoke monster coming out of Melisandre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Melisandre's nether regions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like kind of in the books as well, it kind of eases you into this whole magical thing, because in the first book, Game of Thrones, I it kind of surprised me that there was even like a magical element to it, and then as the books go on, magic becomes more and more of a big part. So I don't know. I guess it'll be interesting to see how they continue to do the brand dreams and all that sort of stuff. I mean, Joe Doug, what are your thoughts there?
Starting reading through the books, kind of always had it in the back of my mind that maybe there wasn't any real magic, and there was always, it was all always kind of based in reality.
Yeah, like some wildfire kind of magic.
Right.
Sort of thing.
Yeah, that's napalm basically or whatever. Yeah. But obviously, what with the smoke monster and this warging and stuff like that, I mean, that can't be true. It's fine. I mean, like the magic, is fun, and overall, I thought the reads were okay, Jojen and Mira. What did you guys think about their introduction? And Jojen's not nearly as creepy as he was in the book, at least to me. He seems to be a little bit normal. And if you, I mean, that's weird because he's not normal at all.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly still came across as being a wise and kind of old for his years boy, but he's kind of straight up creepy in the books, like really all settling and kind of
Well, I mean, he didn't really get to do much in this episode. I mean, basically any time he was talking, it was like explaining to Bran and the audience like what Bran's dreams are and like what Bran is, you know. So he wasn't. I mean, besides just randomly showing up in the dream, like he didn't really have the chance to get good and creepy, you know.
That's true.
Yeah, I guess not yet. but yeah, and yeah, I like the Reeds. I like both of them. I thought they were solid, and I'm totally okay with not having seen them at all last season. You know, we really didn't need them to be in Winterfell as they were in the books. But yeah, I mean, but I just don't see where Jojen's gonna be any more of a character than he was this episode. Yeah. So I don't know if we're ever gonna see him be too creepy or anything like that. As much as I'd like to see that,
he might get creepy in some dreams. I feel
maybe
a little creepy there, but yeah.
I can only hope so.
Yeah, their introduction was, I guess they kind of played up on the creepiness too, because they just kind of came out of nowhere, you know, and they were just like, Bran, you are the future of the world, basically. You need to let us come with you, as opposed to the books where it has definitely more of just like, oh, we meet them in court and then they run away sort of thing. So I guess that kind of plays into the whole magical, you know, something's kind of a little off kilter with these Reeds.
True that. I like how they alluded to Howland Reed saving Ned Stark's life once also.
Yeah, yeah. And how he just started bawling for the first time in his life when Ned was dead.
Yeah.
To the other introduced Stark, reintroduced Stark and Arya, as her and her band of Gendry and Hot Pie get...
Hot Pie!
Get taken up in the woods by
guys, we have to stop for a second. I just came across a picture online. I'm saying it to both of you right now. This continue recording by all means. This is Game of Thrones related. It's a picture of our boy Sam with a Sansa Stark actress and Natalie Dormer, who is Marguerite Tyrell.
Oh man,
it's coming through now. It's coming through now.
This is gonna be something special.
It's a them at some premiere or something like that. So they're all kind of fancied up, but oh man, it's nice.
Sam Wise.
Where did you send this? What? Email? I didn't get any links. Okay. Oh yes, that is good. God, he is made. That is a face right there.
Yeah, he definitely looks better with his raggedy ass facial hair north of the wall than he does clean shaven.
He looks like an ogre, or like a hunchback or something comparatively.
Oh no!
Yeah.
And Sansa's got a huge face and is really tall.
I'm assuming that's. I'm not shocked that she's a lot taller than both of those other two people, and I'm assuming her big face is just a result of maybe being closer to the camera.
Oh, no.
But you never really know.
It's true. In any case,
yeah, back to the original discussion.
We'll definitely post that link up on the in the post of the of the podcast for everyone to enjoy. But yeah, so Arya in the woods with Hot Pie and Gendry get taken up, not really kidnapped, but forcefully. I don't know, whatever. By Thoros and Angai.
Yeah, Angai was awesome.
Yeah, he really threaded the needle with that arrow.
They both were very on point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the first mention, I believe it's the first mention, or at least the first definitely the first introduction of the Brotherhood, who...
Was it called the Brotherhood Without Borders in the books?
Banners. Without Banners.
That's so cheesy.
Yeah. What can you do? I mean, they're basically a Robin Hood sort of outfit.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're just hodgepodge pieces of armies that have been decimated and kind of joined together. I'd be shocked if they could have came up with a more creative name, to be honest. I'm impressed with what they got.
Yeah. My main issue is, I mean, I know, you know, clearly we've read the books, so I know kind of what to expect with them, but I'm wondering if, like, their introduction and their inclusion, at least as brief as it was in this episode, was kind of confusing for people that haven't read the books.
Yeah, I mean, they've been talking about the Brotherhood Without Borders for a while, so, I mean, they didn't really describe a whole lot about them yet, right?
No, they just they've certainly been alluded to once or twice, but there hasn't been, and we know that they've been a thorn in the Lannister side, certainly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they haven't really been mentioned too much more than that, and they certainly haven't been mentioned as being same-sided with the Starks by any means or anything like that. So there's definitely an air of mystery around them, and I thought that was a good thing, and I like how they're not obviously good or bad necessarily at this point. I like how they can kind of go either way.
Yeah, I mean, they're just kind of protecting the people that are
right,
in the middle.
Right, right. I mean, they're clearly decent people, but that's really about all we know about it, and that's just saying that they're nice, semi-nice to children, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They fed and attempted to get Arya a beer, so yes. Obviously they're good people.
And, of course, I think they only had, what, two scenes with him, maybe three. Yeah, at the bar, as Arya is about to get left, be able to leave, the Hound immediately fingers her, and all of a sudden the entire bar is up in arms, it seemed like. So it should be interesting to see what happens with that. It was nice to see the Hound again.
Yeah. I mean, we had the reintroduction of two characters in really short scenes, and the Hound was one, and it was great to see him again, and we'll probably talk about the other one a little bit later, but let's just to stay on topic with the Brotherhood. In the books, they were a lot of the Brotherhood are Northmen, and Harwin, the old guys. I think it was the old guys whose head got chopped off. Wasn't his son who recognized Arya in the books?
Yeah, maybe.
Obviously, you know, with the TV show, we're getting rid of as many minor characters as we can because there's already so many major characters. But I like the Hound recognizing Arya because they'll definitely have some scenes together in the near future, and I'm glad that, you know, that's happening.
Yeah.
And then the last of the reintroductions of, I guess, the principal characters, at least, came with Jaime Lannister, the Kingslayer, and Brienne. And I think that might be my favorite vein of plot line through the whole story, just because, I mean, not necessarily in the books, but I mean in the show, I feel like Brienne and Jaime just have really awesome chemistry, and Jaime just gets like crack wise the entire time, and it's just really enjoyable to watch.
Yeah,
it is. It's pretty comedic, as you said, but then it also does have like those great kind of thinking moments, like when they when Jaime's trying to get Brienne to kill the random dude peddling goods, saying that that he thinks that he recognized them, and Brienne doesn't, and obviously kind of comes back to bite her in the ass. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, it's interesting, certainly. Obviously, Jaime would have slipped that dude's throat as soon as he had a chance.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, it's clear that, like, he's trying to – I mean, maybe he's just trying to get under her skin by, like, trying to make her feel that things aren't as black and white as they appear to be, or she wants them to be, at least.
Right, right. Well, I mean, yeah, definitely. And I think that's her starting to realize it too, that you know, she's always been a pretty judgmental person, especially when it comes to the goodness of Renly and the badness of Jaime, and her starting to see that you know, it's not all that clear is you know, interesting to see, at least.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they continue to work at that angle instead of just kind of letting the story go through. It should continue on, but it'll be interesting to see how much more focus they put on it, or if they just kind of like try to make sure that all the plot points hit throughout their story through the season.
Right.
Now the fight on the bridge. What did you guys think? I personally thought that it looked kind of crappy myself. It lacked some intensity, and I thought that maybe – it definitely seemed that at times Brienne was just toying with Jaime, but I don't know But at other times, you know, clearly they wanted some dramatic, you know, arc in the fight. But I mean, I don't know. It just seemed like with the shots and how they cut it, it seemed to like lack, you know, kind of like an the intensity that you might expect for Jaime and Brienne to fight to sword fight. Even though Jaime is clearly emaciated from what he used to be.
Yeah.
Batman, I would completely agree with you. It definitely, you know, the episode was building to it too. I mean, that was supposed to be kind of the big finale of this episode, and you know, it's not. I don't think it was really. You know, it's not really supposed to be overly competitive.
Epic or anything.
But it definitely seemed to lack a little. I mean, there didn't seem to really be a lot of hatred coming from Jaime, and I don't. Yeah, I'm kind of with you. It was kind of dull for me. I mean. I didn't really enjoy it that much. And, you know, I thought even if they were trying to have just show Brienne kind of messing with Jaime, I thought they could have played that up a little bit more, you know, have her hot dogging it a little bit or something,
Yeah.
I thought that would have been great just to have her kind of get under Jaime's skin a little bit. But yeah.
Yeah, kind of get him back for what he was doing earlier in the episode.
Yeah.
Although
him saying that he would have remembered her dour head hitting all the doorways was hilarious.
Yes, that was good. Yes. It was maybe it was because it didn't really seem like Jaime was trying to escape. You know, like if you're gonna, you would think that if he was going to pull a sword on his captor, it would be to, you know, either kill her or at least like maim her enough so that he could escape. But I didn't really get the sense that Jamie's end game was actually to escape, you know?
No, yeah, definitely. I mean, you would have thought that he would have, like, you know, made a charge, knocked her over, and then taken the F off or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, it's not, I mean, but what happens if when he starts running away, though? I mean, he's not going to, like, be able to stop and, like, untie himself and stuff like that, is he?
Well, no, I mean, it just kind of lacked... I don't know. I guess the fight just lacked him. It just didn't seem. It seemed like maybe they were feeling each other out as opposed to like an actual real fight that was supposed to have like consequences on how things were going, I suppose. But I don't know. That's how I felt about it, at least. And then of course, Roose Bolton's bastard comes up and makes sure to recapture them. I guess.
Well, that wasn't his bastard. That was.
I thought that was Vargo.
No, yeah, that was their.
Although it was not listening.
That was their substitute for Vargo Hoth.
That
not
was Vargo?
His name. Yeah, but he's named something else. And obviously in the TV show he's a bannerman of, or you know, and being paid off by. I mean, he's with Flayed Men, so yeah. he's affiliated with the Boltons at least, which I kind of like. I like that, you know. I don't know exactly how it's going to work necessarily with some of the stuff coming up soon, but I like how they're getting the Boltons and just in general more involved and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's on me then. I thought it was his bastard, but
clearly. No, I think his name is like Archer or something like that. Where we probably saw his bastard at some point, and I'm not sure exactly which one was supposed to be the bastard. Was with that other character who I mentioned earlier with the kind of a quick catching up to with and that was with Theon Greyjoy.
Yeah.
Being. He wasn't really flayed. He had a couple screws driven into him and whatnot, and had his fingernail taken off. And you know that's starting to get going, which was shocking to me. Actually, for some reason, I didn't even think about them having Theon Greyjoy really in the season at all. This is material that's coming from the fifth book, so I mean it makes sense to keep him included. From what I've seen on some other things, the directors talked about how much they liked Alfie Allen, how they wanted to make sure they kept him around a little bit. And, mm-hmm. I was really pleasantly surprised that he was included, and I'm glad that they did.
I always just assumed he was dead. I haven't read the fifth book, so.
So that was an even bigger shock for the bag.
No, I was completely shocked. I was like, what is going on here?
Batman, you haven't read the fifth book yet?
No, I have not read the fifth book.
Oh, shit.
I'm waiting for that paperback price, son.
This is really funny. It's just completely off topic of people not knowing things that are about to happen. Joe Dog and my sister, one of our sisters, Katie, is in the middle of watching season one, and she's 8 episodes into it, and she is refusing to watch the 9th episode until this Sunday for some reason. And so, like, I was trying to think of what happens in the ninth episode of the first season, because I'm like, oh, you know, I know they always do big things, and it's the Ned Stark scene. Yeah. So at one point we were talking, but I just started laughing. She was like, why are you laughing? And I was like, oh, man, you need to watch that ninth episode.
Who is that?
Katie.
Katie's watching them?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
What is it? That's yeah, she needs to get on that ninth episode grind immediately.
Yeah, we can start having her on the podcast.
Mm-hmm. We could. It could just become the Shrums plus Bagman.
Indeed.
Perspective.
With Theon, did you? Who was that guy that was supposedly helping him?
Supposed
to know or not?
I don't know, and we really get into the spoiler alerty things when we start talking about the people that are with Theon in that scene. Obviously, he says that he's sent from Yara, from his sister, and is there to help. He didn't certainly seem too helpful, really. I mean, you know, he kind of untied him and then left the door open and kind of got out of there as fast as possible.
Yeah. All right. And then we also got a couple of updates this week with mainly Rob, I suppose, and of course what's going down in King's Landing with Marjorie and Joffrey and Sansa and
the Queen of Thorns.
Yeah, the Queen of Thorns was very enjoyable. She was just hating.
Yeah, just a professional hater.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she clearly, she was a professional hater. It wasn't just like she was old and crotchety, you know? Like
she was enjoying herself.
She was on her hate grind for many, many years before she got old.
So. Yeah, no, definitely. And the thing that, where I really like it is they make it, they don't make it seem as evil or like as sinister really with her. Mm-hmm. You know, there's something kind of charming about this old lady being, kind of crotchety.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, it was great. I really enjoyed that dynamic. I mean, Sansa's acting was, you know, a little wooden, I guess, or her mood swings didn't feel her emotional swings didn't kind of feel believable, even though, you know. But I thought the scene was still really enjoyable because of the Queen of Thorns.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that she had a baller-ass chalice filled with cheese.
What kind of cheese was that? That cheese was disgusting looking.
No, that cheese was probably delicious.
That wasn't no Kraft American slices of cheese. That was like some weird goat cheese up in this piece.
Yeah, that looked like it was. That I would definitely eat some chalice of cheese. And then, meanwhile, going on and later in the episode, we get another awesome scene between Joffrey and Margaery. That I think really helps solidify and bring out Marjorie's character, and I thought she did a really good job in that scene, going from fearful after hearing what Sansa had to say to really turning it in her favor, and then basically creepy ass Joffrey just, you know. Enjoying his crossbow a little too much.
Yeah, well, as you said with Sansa, I mean, some of the when they initially casted all this, you know, that they were pretty proud of how spot on or what have you that all the characters were, how they looked, and maybe how well they acted. But they, I mean, we've certainly seen that Sansa, Jon Snow, and after Sunday's episode, whoever plays Bran, Isaac Hampshire, or whatever, are clearly not very good actors. They certainly aren't great. But I would say the complete opposite is true for Jack Gleeson, and then obviously Natalie Dormer's been in other stuff. But yeah, that scene was fantastic with the two of them.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, you could definitely see the emotions just like melt and like turn, and it was just great to see how how she was able to manipulate Joffrey, especially after Joffrey's little talk with his mom, where he clearly did not listen to his mom's warnings.
He kind of did. His initial line of questioning with Margaery was definitely kind of induced by his mom, by what his mom was saying. He kind of got up on her case a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Bit. I mean, of course, when you're going to see Joffrey and in like his room, and he's just holding a crossbow when he says hello, you know, you're gonna be on edge a little bit. That's
yeah, cool. Yeah. You're on your toes.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's obviously much more capable of playing the game than Sansa, And that, yeah, that should be kind of an interesting little kind of a duel, you know, between them, or really just her, you know, her scheming, because obviously Jeffrey doesn't have the capacity to scheme.
He's clueless.
Yeah. And so it should be fun to watch her trying to kind of piece him out, but also staying out of his way. So yeah, it'll be fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Other than that, were there any other major things to point out? I mean, we got like a little update north of the wall with both John and Sam, but nothing really happened there. I guess Rob, he finally got the news of Winterfell being burned and his grandfather dying at River Run.
Right.
And we got a little bit more of Karstark being like, yo, Rob, you're blowing it. But,
definitely, and then no, and then we had the scene with Caitlin and Lady Tanitha where she talks about the when she's made those two Dream Weaver things in the past, yeah. One with Bran and then one with Jon Snow getting into the Shanks or something like that.
Yeah. That, I mean, I thought that was interesting with the Jon Snow one. But yeah, no, I mean, nothing too major happened, but I guess the main trouble I foresee happening with future episodes of the show is maybe, I mean, as we get further into the books, the episodes or the universe expands, you know, they go, you know, everyone has different stories, they're all going different places, and I mean, they'll run into each other occasionally, but for the most part, everything's just continues to kind of expand and expand, and I feel like...
No, I wouldn't necessarily say expand and expand, but certainly stay separate. I mean, you know, for the most part, like you said, there might be a few intersecting parts here and there, but yeah, we don't really have the locations certainly stay varied and many. So
yeah, so
we didn't get any Stannis, did we? Or in Davos?
No, we didn't get any of that, and we didn't get any Dany either.
Yeah, I remember not getting any Dany.
So. But
it's just too much to do.
This is kind of my worry is that, I mean, even though they did have kind of a nice scene there between Catelyn and Lady Talisa there, it seems like the show is starting to become more and more kind of like almost a timeline where they just kind of pick and choose the scenes to make sure that the plot moves forward, but we're not getting like kind of the depth that we got, especially in like season one.
Well, I would certainly say that it's you're right. It's definitely starting to be kind of timeline, and I would say that was kind of the big problem with a couple of the earlier Harry Potter movies is that it really just seemed like it was a bunch of the people who were directing it and making the show, movies in that case, just had specific scenes they really wanted to put on camera,
mm-hmm.
and then they did that and then just threw it in there. You know, the really great TV shows that have been on in the past 10 years or so, you know, they do a great job of having not only seasonal, you know, plot arcs, not only kind of the entire show running plot arcs, but then also episodic plot arcs. And that's something certainly that's missing from the Game of Thrones. And I'm not sure they'll ever really have it just because they're going to be jumping around so much. There's no way to have any really kind of continuity in one scene throughout an episode.
Yeah. And I mean, it's they definitely are making sure to hit all the major plot points because, I mean, that's important to move the story along. But yeah, they definitely aren't episodes. They don't stand alone, except, you know, maybe like the ones Georgie Porgy there writes, you know, or the ones like right before, you know, the season finales or whatever, which you could clearly be like, oh, that's clearly the Ned Stark chopping off episode or whatever, head chop off episode.
Well, would you want them to take more of a novelist approach where they're like, all right, this is the Theon episode, this is the Dany episode, this is the Arya episode? Would you want them to do that, or do you like it mixed up?
I mean, I personally wouldn't like that, but I think it might be interesting if they had episodes with like the three same characters. Like maybe we won't see Arya, Bran, and Jaime next episode, but we'll see them, you know, the episode after that, you know, so it kind of shifts off like that. I thought that might be an interesting way to do it. But clearly, like, some plots are just more important than others, at least within the third book, so I don't think there's a way that they could really do that.
Yeah.
Jimmy TV, you have anything to say about that?
Well, I mean, I kind of already did. I wish that they did have more kind of a, and even if they made it something as trying to put similar themed maybe stuff in each episode, I would like it more if I could. I mean, like we were saying, you know, if I was just going to sit down and watch an episode of Game of Thrones, I'm not sure that I really would or could. You know, I'm not even sure if I would bother doing that because I know that I wouldn't want to just watch one episode. I'd want to watch, you know, this
thing, yeah.
Well, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, just the one storyline that I'm looking for play out a little bit. So I think, you know, the most scenes they have with specific characters per episode, it seems like it's two, and, you know, at the very absolute most three, just so they have screen time for everyone else. So I'm not sure if I'd certainly want to see more than that. So I guess I'd want to see at least one more, you know, I would like there for there at least be three scenes, four scenes with, following one character. So just, we could get a little bit more, continuity throughout the episode, but you know, even then I'm not sure if it would be necessarily better or anything like that. I mean, I think we'd still just be seeing these important scenes of this character's storyline through the season.
Yeah. All right, well, I think that's gonna do it for the Game of Thrones talk this week. Do you guys have anything to add before we go on?
Do you think that the guy that's there to help out Theon was actually sent by his sister, or is that just someone trying to get it, you know, up to no good?
I think he was probably sent by his sister. I mean, I have no clue what's going on there, so.
Okay, spoiler alert?
No, I mean, you don't have to. I'm sure we'll get more Theon.
The thing is, it's not necessarily spoilers.
I mean that.
Well, no. Let's just put it this way: in those two scenes with Theon, there is a relative. Not. I didn't know the person was famous at all, but I guess he's done some BBC stuff, and he's kind of famous across the pond. One of the actor who ended up letting Theon who was talking with Theon is kind of a famous person who is billed, I think, and maybe even a couple of the other episodes. So we definitely haven't seen the last of him. That's certainly for sure.
Yeah. But, all right. That it?
Do you want to briefly talk about that trailer you sent around?
We can leave that for next week. I mean,
oh,
I think,
a little tease.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I'll probably be talking to Alan a bunch about his TV show. So, although I still want to try to keep it to like a one pod, so. We'll talk about it next week. Maybe we'll talk about a couple other trailers as well for things that we might be interested, looking forward to.
So I mean, if you guys wanted to do some homework, listeners and Jose, the things that I was kind of mentioned, the Bagman, along with that trailer, were the Kick-Ass 2 trailer, the Great Gatsby trailer. Mm-hmm. What else was there? They're remaking Carrie, so that's two Chloe Moretz movies or whatever her name is. I thought there was one else, and then The End of the World or whatever, the new movie with
the Seth Rogen one.
Yeah, the Seth Rogen and yeah.
I'm particularly interested in Pacific Rim, but I'm not quite sure there's any trailers out yet, and it looks like it could be awful but awesome at the same time. So I'll do some research on that. And hopefully there will be something that we can watch for next year.
Yeah. I've seen a trailer for Pacific Rim. I'm almost positive I have, or a promo at least, or something. I've definitely seen something with Charlie Hunnam up in it, because Charlie Hunnam's my boy.
But all right, yeah. So we're gonna kick it over to Alan now. Alan and me talking about some Mad Men and about his projects. So why don't you Shrums say goodbye?
Nighty night, everybody.
Jimmy TV, peacing out.
All right, so now that we've lost Jimmy TV and Joe Doug, we have made up for their loss with the addition of Alan, our resident Mad Men enthusiast and actor.
Yeah.
Alan apparently has just received a guest spot on The X's, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's a co-star is what it's called.
Oh, it's a co-star? That sounds pretty good.
That's actually less.
Oh.
Than guest star would it? Yeah, I know it makes it sound like it's more, but really it was. I'm just in one scene, and like on a show, whenever you know there's somebody who's just like in one scene or you know a couple scenes or anything like that, it's called a co-star. You just have like five lines or less.
Well, hey, it's a speaking role. That's definitely something.
Oh, yeah. It was a very awesome experience. Yeah, the show is The X's, which I hadn't heard of before I got the part. I thought it was a new show, but apparently it's going into its third season.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a sitcom on TV Land starring Donald Faison, who everybody knows is Murray from Clueless, and Turk on Scrubs. And I think I didn't watch Scrubs. I'm pretty sure his name was Turk.
Yeah, he was also in Remember the Titans.
Was he? I never saw that movie.
Yes, yes. He could not. He had a case of fumbleitis, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
And it's also Wayne Knight, Newman from Seinfeld.
Awesome.
And from Jurassic Park, and also Kristen Johnson, who was the woman on 30 Rock from the Sun.
And Wayne Knight was in that show too for a little
bit. Yes.
So what's like the show about, or I guess what's your role in the show?
Well, the show itself is about three guys who are all divorced. The main character is an actor who I don't know. I can't even remember his name. I think it was David something. He's like, you know, just kind of like a good looking guy who's been on TV a long time. He'll usually like come in for like an episode of a cop show or play someone's boyfriend and something, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And he plays this guy who just got divorced, doesn't know what to do with his life or where even to live, because, you know, his wife gets everything. So his divorce lawyer, played by Kristen Johnson, gets him. She puts him up with two other guys who she's done divorces for, who are Wayne Knight and Donald Faison, and the three of them kind of live together. And they're, you know, they're a little mismatched, but they've all had that in common, that they, you know, they're all kind of trying to move on from these divorces, and she kind of is like a babysitter for these three adult men. I think she owns the apartment that she moved them into. I think she's like subletting it from them or something like that.
Okay.
So, you know.
And so what's your role? What do you get to do?
What I was doing, and again, it was very minimal. The episode involves the three guys going to a sex shop, like a porn store, to replace something of Kristen Johnson's that they broke. And the gag that I'm involved in is pretty much Wayne Knight's character trying to say that he had never been to this store before, and my character, I play a guy who works at the store, and I just say something I just recognize him and say something to him that reveals that oh, okay, he's a regular here.
Yeah, that he frequents often.
Right, exactly. So it's just a little, like, gag.
Oh, that's cool. That's still cool. Is this, like, your first kind of major...
Yeah, this is the first... This is the first, I guess technically first speaking role that I've had on television. It's my first co-star credit, and I have had... I actually had a couple lines on another sitcom, Demi Lovato's old sitcom on Disney Channel called Sunny with a Chance. But neither of those were considered co-star because of the rules of how it was set up. I was just a background character who at one point I had a line, but it was like five of us saying the line at the same time. Okay. So that doesn't count.
Okay.
And then there was another episode where I played a member of an entourage. Of like this one actor's entourage, and there was another episode where he points to me and goes, "This guy is my laugh guy," and I go, "Ah," ha, 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 and he goes, "Shut up."
Nice.
So even though that's a line, like it was a line in the script, they don't. I guess because it wasn't words, you know, it was just like fake laughing at everything he says, they don't really count that.
Okay.
So yes, this was my first co-star official line on TV, and I'll get that credit on IMDb. So I guess I got to start up. I got to plunk down the money to start an IMDb profile.
That is exciting.
Yeah.
Have you gotten? Do you have anything else in the works currently? Are you auditioning for anything that looks promising? Or?
No, I had a call back last week for a commercial. I really thought I was going to get it. I had a good time with them, but I did not get it. I didn't hear back from them. And I'm just going to continue auditioning, for commercials. And then I've kind of found, I don't have an agent who can get me auditions for television and film, but the way I got this audition, the way I got this role on the TV show was that I went to a workshop of a casting director who liked me, and he called me in for this role. Oh, nice. So I guess I'll just keep doing that. It's kind of a way to skirt around the agent problem out here.
Yeah, a little get some networking going.
Exactly. So I guess I'm just going to keep doing that.
Well, and hopefully the next workshop you attend is one that Matthew Weiner is a part of.
Oh, God. Yeah, that would be fantastic.
So that you can get on Mad Men and I can actually talk to someone that's been on the show, because that would be awesome. And people might actually go to the site as well.
Yeah, bring in some new eyes with that little bit of a, say like you have a cameo.
Yeah, but yeah, so this past weekend, Mad Men debuted a two-part episode called The Doorway.
Yes.
You know, this is the premiere of season 6, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I believe next season will be the last season, so this is the penultimate season.
Yes, it is.
I don't know. What were your thoughts? I personally felt a little underwhelmed.
Yeah.
Yeah, by the episode. I don't know. It didn't seem to have. I felt like Matthew Weiner might have been like trying a little too hard to purport, like, you know, the themes that he usually, you know, weaves in there so well, and just it wasn't heavy handed, but it didn't have like that Mad Men coolness to it. I mean, maybe that's the point. But I don't know. I felt a little. I didn't feel like it was a. It certainly for me wasn't like a classic episode of Mad Men.
I felt the complete opposite, actually. I mean, first of all, I really did enjoy the episode, but because of that reason, that I don't feel like it was a different. I think that what we're seeing is that the world is changing around these characters.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt from the get go, this was kind of a classic episode about, I think the series in general is, you know, a character study about these people and about change. And I felt like this episode was really about, you know, the inevitability of who we are and how it takes us, where it takes us in life. Mm-hmm. If it's possible to get on or off the tracks that we're on, and you know, with the title, The Doorway, coming from Roger's little speech that he gave to his therapist, I think that really set up like the theme of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, him, his crisis that he was going through in this episode, where he kind of, his personal crisis in life is that he is starting to realize that he's not changing, that he thought that the experiences in life and going from new thing to new thing would be more like a path. But now he's just looking at life as a series of doors that just open temporarily and close behind you, and you can't go back. And that's just a straight line to, like he said, you know what, you know, to your death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for the Roger, at least for Roger's point of view, and some of the other characters probably feel the same way, that there's no hope for change. And I think that was kind of permeating throughout the entire episode.
Yeah, no, it was that definitely was a big part. I mean, I agree with you that it definitely set up at least the theme of the episode, if not for the entire season, that like no matter how much we might want to change or how much we try to change, there's just some things we can't change. And I thought that definitely came up, especially when the reveal of Don having sex with Arnie's wife there.
Yeah.
Of Freaks and Geeks and ER fame. I can't remember the actress's name at the moment, or the character's name for that matter. So
yeah,
that's on me.
I think her character is Sylvia on Mad Men.
Okay. Well, I'm sure I could look it up as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, so and so after their little tryst or whatever, I believe Don had a line that was just like, you know, I hate the fact that we're doing this, you know, something along those lines.
Yeah,
was
she, just like, she asked, I know. She asked him what he wanted for New Year's, and he said, I want to stop doing this.
Yeah.
She said, I know.
Exactly. So, I mean, thought. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting the first line of the episode of Don quoting I guess it wasn't the first thing said, but at the beginning, Don quoting the beginning of Dante's Inferno, which he was reading on the beach. I think I wrote it down that it said, "In the middle of the journey of our life, I found myself in a dark wood, for the straight way was lost." I think that summed up this episode and kind of the entire series for Don, at least. Don's whole thing in this episode seemed to be about escape and death, and that I loved how it was funny to me afterwards, but in the moment I felt sorry for him. I loved how it kind of he accidentally evoked death in his pitch for the hotel with the footprints on the beach leading out into the ocean. I don't think he meant to project such a dark image, but his subconscious is just kind of like slipping out in that moment.
I'll get to that in a second. Yeah, I mean, just to go back to the whole Dante's Inferno thing, it's clear that Don ends up marrying or dating the women that are, I guess, more trophies, you know, people that, you know, aren't perhaps as deep as, you know, you would want them to be. And then, of course, all of his flings seem to be with, you know, the creative types that get that side of his character, but that might not, like, you know, it might not hold up the appearances of, like, what he believes, you know, he should be.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that the people he tries to stay with are the people he believes are on the straight way, you know, who he believes that are, you know, kind of like perfect trophies, like you said. And then I think that was part of what he was trying to stop Megan from doing last season. I think that was part of the reason, other than his selfish reasons, I think that was why he didn't want her to become an actress and to leave Sterling Cooper, because he didn't want her to become the kind of girl that he would usually just have a fling with.
Mm-hmm.
I loved that the woman came up to her, came up to Megan at the hotel and called her Corinne, called her character's name.
Yes.
Kind of, parallel to how Don is Don instead of Dick. Now Megan has two names too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the juxtaposition of, like, Don reading serious art on the beach, where it's just supposed to be, like, kind of throwaway frivolities, you know, in Hawaii, where it's just, you know, all-inclusive, you know, you don't have a care in the world, you're not supposed to, sort of thing. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah.
But yeah, how'd you feel about first Don, of course, giving the private's wife away on the beach, and then his constant, like, flirtation with the lighter. I mean, I guess that kind of plays into the whole, you know, no matter what you do, you can't change sort of thing, because no matter what he did, the lighter ended up coming back and reminding him of his past.
I thought the lighter thing was actually really cool, because the guy, Dinkins, PFC Dinkins,
yes,
was,
yes.
He made some kind of quip at the bar of, you know, hey, you know, one day I'll be you, I'll take your personality. And, you know, that got Don probably thinking about how, you know, he took another soldier's identity. And what was cool about the lighter is that I think that the lighter that he probably accidentally gave to Dinkins, which Dinkins probably took with him to war.
Yeah.
It was probably the last thing that one of the last things that Don owned that actually belonged to Dick.
Yeah.
And was also that was also the same lighter that he accidentally dropped, which caused the explosion, which allowed him to turn into Don.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, a lot of his looking at that lighter was, you know, Don examining where he is in life, this very much the same way Roger is of, you know, what he was kind of propelled to where he is and wondering if he could get off this path and wondering, you know, where is this taking him? And it seemed like he was just really fixated on death in this episode.
Yeah. I mean, to go back to the pitch, I personally didn't even associate it with death. I mean, I guess that, you know, they brought up the movie, which, you know, he walks into the beach or whatever. But I actually found that to be pretty effective ad, and I thought it was a good ad for what they wanted, but I guess I just didn't associate it with the suicide or the death angle.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, but I think that's the point, that I don't think that I did either, not specifically death, but that image is definitely, depending on who you are, that, or what's going on in your life, that idea of just kind of stripping your clothes off and running into the ocean, if what I was picturing Don doing that, and I think that's what made me think of it in a dark way. But okay. Yeah, I think that's what's so cool about that ad, and you know, about them writing that, is that I think that's the point. For if you have kind of like a darkness about you, that's what you're going to see. And if you don't think of it that way, then it is an effective ad, and it is a good ad.
Yeah, I mean, the ad definitely was all about, you know, as we've just discussed, about, you know, becoming someone else when you hit Hawaii, about how, like, you just get swept up in everything and you're a completely different person. And, like, yeah. You don't even – I believe at some point Don even said, you know, you don't even worry about what's going on back home because you're just in such a different place.
I thought that it was really funny the way Stan summed it up, of just when Don asked him, he's like, of course you made me think of suicide. That's why it's so great.
Yeah. Stan's role seems to be growing a little bit.
Yeah,
it's looking really good. I'm loving it.
I love his ridiculous Zach Galifianakis beard. And I also really like that he and Peggy now seem to be friends, now that they're separated.
Yeah.
You see that they do have this connection, this, you know, two people who have both gone through Don Draper, and they're, you know, going through the same thing.
Yeah, and I mean, they definitely had like a brother-sister sort of relationship, where, you know, he would just make fun, you know, poke jokes and, you know, kind of try to gross her out. And now that they're apart, they've, you know, become closer together in a way.
Yeah.
With the Roger stuff, I think that was one of the things where I felt underwhelmed by the episode, because
– Really?
He was just kind of – I mean, it was clearly just like soliloquies and monologues of Wiener trying to get the point across, you know? Like, I mean, clearly, like, I guess that's kind of the only way that you could do that, to have Roger, like, voice all these opinions the couch there with the psychiatrist. But
I think it seemed pretty normal to me. I mean, for starters, he's always been a neurotic guy, but now that we know he's been experimenting with drugs like LSD, that really do reshape your mind and kind of have you, that can make you start reexamining things. I guess I'm not surprised at all that he was in therapy. And then his mother died. And that, even though he didn't feel anything, that's something that you definitely makes you ponder existence and life. And that's, Roger has been contending with this getting old and what's to become of me much longer than any other of the characters that we've been talking about. So for me, all of his speeches to the therapist made sense. And I loved, I don't know if you want to go there yet, I loved how his story kind of ended up, that he felt nothing really for his mother's death, but it was when the Shoeshine case came that finally broke him, because he can relate to that much more, that no one cared about what happened to this guy except other than the job that he did and what he left behind. And when Roger just sees that brush is the only thing that's left, he saw himself in that and then just broke down finally.
I'll comment on that in a second. I just wanted to say, maybe it was the fact that Roger is in the psychiatrist's office at all, maybe threw me off a little bit, I suppose. Because, I mean, Roger has never been – I don't believe he's ever been a proponent of it. So, I mean, clearly, I mean, it kind of works with his character, because clearly – throughout this episode, it was brought to light that no one actually really cares about Roger, or had really cared about him, at least since Mona, before he divorced her. So, I mean, I thought the shoeshiner's wife sending his case to to Roger made, you know, everything kind of well up and hit home with him the most because...
Well, but on that, what you're talking about, I mean, don't you think that it makes sense that Roger's in therapy, not only just because of what I was just saying, that, you know, he has been experimenting with drugs, but I think...
Well, I mean, he's paying someone to care for him, to care about him.
Right, yeah, exactly. There's that, and he's been trying to find some sort of outlet for years now. I think the marriage to the younger woman, and then when he was dictating... trying to write his memoirs, you know, that I think that was another attempt to you know, be able to release and to emote what he has all stocked up inside, and then with the LSD, and so I it makes sense to me that someone like Roger would end up here.
Yeah, I don't know. I for some odd reason, I guess maybe it was just the shock of him seeing him, even though clearly he. You know, he wasn't using it for the purposes that it was supposed to be used for, I suppose.
Yeah.
Let's see. What do we want to go to next here? There's a ton of stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, Don was going through that, Roger was going through that, and then I think the other main person we were following this episode was Betty.
Yeah.
And
she definitely was... I mean, she seemed to be trying to change herself as well. I remember, I have a note down here... where the first time her and Henry are in bed, she's making, like, really weird rape jokes.
Yeah.
About Sandy, the 15-year-old violinist, almost protege violinist, which is completely out of character for Betty. And I don't know if maybe... I don't know. I mean, that was really shocking. And it was clear that, I mean, Betty was kind of... seemed like Betty was kind of trying to reconnect with her youth, but she was also met by the fact that times have clearly changed as well.
Well, what I saw was that this was another case of, you know, of everyone was going through this in this episode, but she saw herself in someone else. And I think she saw herself in Sandy, mm-hmm. This girl who just lost her mother. Betty very much has been kept a child most of her life. So she's always, this whole series, she's always related to younger people, like with the freak Glenn.
Yes.
But as much of an unlikable person as Betty is, I have always had kind of a soft spot for what she's able to do for who she is. And I think it's incredible that she's someone who was willing to go into the darkness and stay at that slum house for hours trying to find Sandy. Cause I think she wanted to keep, to go back to Dante. She wanted to keep Sandy on the straight way and out of the dark wood.
Yes.
And she was willing to go into the dark wood looking for Sandy and kind of have some balls with those guys in the slum. Like, here Betty is, this, you know, blonde rich woman with her purse and kind of like talking back to these guys that she's surrounded by.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, she definitely wasn't taking any guff.
Yeah.
She was definitely making sure that she at least tried to maintain some semblance of power.
That situation could have gone way other way.
Oh, like,
that
yeah.
could have been the end of Betty's life in kind of a traumatic, violent way. But,
it could have gone south really quickly.
Yeah. But she not only stood up to them, but even when the guy was just like, leave the violin, she just mouthed off to him and took off with it.
Well, I mean, you said, and I agree, that her character has always kind of been trying to relate through, you know, younger people. And do you think her putting the violin down at the end was her realizing that either she can't relate with those people anymore, or just that, like, the times have changed and that she just doesn't – she – I mean, I guess she wouldn't – you know, do you think she feels like she's gotten old, or do you just think that she's kind of blamed it on how things have changed? Because clearly, like, she mentioned the fact that she used to live in the village when she was, you know, an up-and-coming model. And clearly that was not the village she lived in, you know. Clearly things had gone for the worse down there, so.
Right. I don't know. I honestly was kind of wondering why she put the violin down, but best I could make of it, I mean, from what happened in the episode, I would think that she kind of took her own advice, or when she was kind of yelling at these guys, or when she was not yelling, but like talking back to them and saying, you know, what are you going to do with this violin? You can't, like, what are you going to do with it? What's the point of you holding on to this? I think when she kind of got through with that situation, she asked herself, what's the point of going, of walking out with this either? That there's nothing that she can do with the violin. And I think what was significant about that for Betty is that she's someone whose fate had been dictated her whole life. People controlled her and told her what to do and where to go. And maybe she kind of decided in that moment to let the girl go, and, you know, let Sandy go and let her kind of just do her own thing and see what happens.
And maybe have Betty change herself a little bit in the process.
Yeah.
If that's possible, of course.
I don't know. But that was very weird, that stuff she was saying in bed. That was
off-putting. I didn't really understand how that kind of tied into everything else.
I think Betty has a darkness about her, and she had it already, but she got a lot of it from her relationship with Don, or it got amplified in those years living with Don.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then the other main focus of the episode would have to be on Peggy over at the other agency there.
Yeah.
Clearly things. I mean, there were a couple things happening there. The first, of course, that's Teddy Shaw's agency, I believe, right? That's
his name. Yeah.
So first, it was clear that they wanted to show how different Don ran things with how Shaw and his people ran things, as Peggy not only was not supported, but, like, it was clear that they just cared about making the client happy as opposed to trying to sell their idea to the client. I thought that was pretty good and interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was another thing about that situation over there. It took me a while to recognize Bert Peterson over there, because I knew I recognized him, the guy who called her in the first place at midnight. But I couldn't remember who he was until I remembered his hilarious scene when he stormed out of Sterling Cooper, breaking everything when the Brits came in when he was fired.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy he's back. I thought that was a funny scene, and I bet we'll see. We know already that if he's pushed, he can be an insane person.
Yes, yes.
But my main takeaway from that was how much Peggy has turned into Don at the office and in her personal life. And I was enjoying watching her operate at this office. I agree a lot more commercial and less artistic than Sterling Cooper Draper Price.
Yeah, I mean, she's clearly almost a Don Jr. there.
Except completely.
Without the people around her that Don had, of course.
Well, yeah, but she has the people who work under her
she uses them exactly how Don used.
She talks to them exactly how Don talked to his people, and even the way she treats her boyfriend and. There's kind of like the way she said, just listen to your music, kid, after they were done talking about the way that she'd been treating her employees. It was just kind of like, you're a kid, you don't know what's going on, just go back to playing with your toys, I'll keep taking care of you.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it was good to see Peggy also have success without Don, like some actual...
Yeah.
Like a good idea. I don't think we've really seen her have like a good idea without Don. I mean, maybe under Don.
She's had
her own ideas, of course.
Yeah.
But, like, we haven't seen her have a good idea at the new agency, I guess, is what I'm trying to
say. Oh, yeah. That's true. Because she's had plenty
of ideas. She's had plenty of ideas. But yeah, at the new agency, I think this was her first kind of major one. So it was definitely good to see that. And then, of course, they seemed – I mean, while she was on the phone with Stan, of course, he – called her out for, Teddy Shaw and her little exchange there.
Yeah.
And the way she looked at him after he left, I mean, do you think that maybe a possibility of a romantic relationship between those two is on the horizon, or do you think
he's teasing it? I think definitely because of the influence that Don has had on Peggy, I think she has that attraction to disaster too. I think she would easily make a mistake like that without thinking of the horrific consequences that will come with hooking up with him.
Well, I mean, yeah, and it definitely seems, well, if she's a Don Jr., then is Teddy then like the trophy that he's going at, that she would be going after, or is she, he like the creative part?
No, the creative, that would be a fling between the two of them. If something happened, it would be purely just for the fun of it, and it would be a disaster, I say, because of how short it would be, because it would just be like a one-time thing or a week-long thing, and it's with her boss who's married, and she's the woman in the situation. I could just easily see her losing her job over it.
Oh, yeah, no. If something does go down, there will be shit hitting the fan all over the place.
Yeah. Another character that we saw that I was happy to continue to see his progress is Pete. I like the continuing independence he's gained. He seems to have lost all of his kind of mystic worship over Don, and the way that he was talking to Don when he got back from his vacation, he just said, "Well, I'm always waiting for you to come back with work, and then you always walk away from me, and then you go take a nap," and he kind of condescendingly, yeah, you know, patted his back. You know, the Pete of a couple seasons ago would never dare talk to Don like that.
Oh, no, not at all. I don't know why Pete all of a sudden, I mean, last episode was a lot about Pete, for sure. He might have been the main or the secondary character of last season, rather.
Yeah, one up. But, well, that, because for the past 2 years, I watched a fourth season episode earlier today, actually, mm-hmm, that kind of mentioned this, but he's continuing to get a bigger piece of the pie. I mean, he's technically a partner, first of all, but more than that, he has
all the big accounts under his name.
Right. He's slowly, it used to be Roger who had the big chunk of it, and he lost Lucky Strike. And Pete kind of, in this episode I watched, he was mentioning to Roger, you know, like, "I know what this is for you. Every time that I make more business, we become less and less dependent on your other accounts." You know, at some point, Pete could represent 60%, 70% of the company. Who knows?
Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, I wonder if also maybe this is some fallout for what Joan ended up doing by sleeping with the Jaguar guy last year. Because before, yeah, Don had founded this agency on creative. Everything was going to be creative. People would be coming in, you know, they would be lining up out on the streets because the creative was so good.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if maybe Pete, you know, since that has happened, Pete has realized that Don's vision has taken a hit, and that, you know, the accounts, getting the accounts are is required on, you know, that kind of not above board behavior, if you will, and maybe, you know, he's kind of sticking it to Don in that way as well.
Yeah, definitely. He's rising in the ranks.
I think we've covered most of it. I want to touch upon just a couple of things. Mm-hmm. And I think the first has to be the new account man they have.
Bob Benson.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what he does. I guess he's a new junior account guy. What did you think of him? He seemed kind of, he definitely seemed like he was trying to suck up a little too hard.
Yeah, yeah, he's a complete kiss ass. Yeah. But who knows how he'll fare? I mean, look at Ginsburg the first time we met him, how much of a jackass he was. But he's there, and he's just a part of the place now. I don't know what's going to happen with this guy. I was enjoying watching everyone's reaction to him.
Oh, they were hating on him so hard. Like,
yeah.
No, I don't think anyone was, like, respected him, which makes me wonder why they hired him in the first place.
Oh, who knows? I'm sure he's talented in some way, but he definitely, I think you're right. I think probably everyone there doesn't like him, because even when Cosgrove was yelling at him at the end of the episode, they kept showing the smile on the secretary's face.
Yeah.
Like, she'd been waiting and hoping for something like this to happen.
Yeah, for someone to call Bob out on his shit. And then, of course, Ken, I mean, when has Ken ever, like, yelled at anyone, you know?
Yeah. I think I don't know what this guy is, but I think he is in accounts because it looked like Ken seemed to be his boss in some way. Yeah. I'm wondering if Ken is like the unofficial king of their new second floor, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, yeah, it was interesting. I mean, Don is no longer on the top floor, so maybe he's also lost a little power there as well. But yeah, and then the other thing I wanted to bring up was the really weird smash cut earlier in the episode where Don's doorman dies, but then like the next scene, it seems like it was beforehand somehow. Like, well, that just didn't make any sense. I mean, it was afterwards, but it just...
It made sense. He didn't die. He had a heart attack.
No, yeah, no, I'm aware of that. It just seemed really weird to, like, immediately cut to another scene where they're being greeted, where he's...
It was jarring for us, but it made sense in the timeline that Don saw him, and we were watching Don see his doorman when he came back from vacation, and Don remembered what happened before. The last time he saw him was when he dropped, when he had his heart attack. The scene that we saw in the very opening of the episode, it was. So I mean,
what I thought was he had the heart attack after they got back, because I thought he said something about like, "How was your trip?" or something, and then he had the heart attack.
Right, because here, what we saw is a very typical thing that they do on TV, but they did it much faster. Just imagine that in the middle of that scene, at the beginning and end of him falling down, they did like the wavy line thing in the harpsichord to signify that it was a flashback. Mm-hmm. If you add that in, then it makes sense. What happened was that at some random time, the last time that Don saw him was when he had a heart attack, before Don and Megan went on vacation. He had the heart attack. That's when the doctor, whatever his name is, saved his life. So when Don and Megan go on vacation, and when they're coming back, this is the first time he's been back, that they've seen him since he's come back on the job and he's okay again. And it was when they were coming back, we're just seeing Don remember the last time you saw him, of when he had the heart attack.
Okay.
That's why they're all like, "Oh, I can't believe you're already back on your feet." And
yeah,
back.
I mean, I understood that the next scene was like afterwards, but it just seemed like it seemed like the first where he had the heart attack happened after they got back from vacation too.
That was just when we saw it. It was a very Sopranos-esque way of showing what a flashback would really be like. There's no lost swell of a bass. And there's no, like I said, there's no like wavy lines and harpsichord and like, you know, blurring of the edges of what we're seeing. Don just quickly flashed on the last time he saw this guy and then was back in the scene.
Okay. So, yeah. I mean, that makes sense. I mean, it still works in the whole grand scheme of things where they're talking about, or where the theme of the episode is, you know, you're away from everything, and then when you get back, all of a sudden.
Right, and I think it was another nice way of forcing Don to kind of combine his vacation with the idea of death. His vacation was bookended by death. Mm-hmm. This guy has a heart attack, almost dies right in front of Don, and then when he comes back, he's gotta be confronted by this guy again. I think it just kind of, again, was weaving in the theme of, like, death and escape, kind of combining them in Don's mind, which makes perfect sense that he'd end up pitching the ad that he did. Mm-hmm. The way that Don talked about the vacation, when he came back and people were like, you know, how was it? You know, what do you have? And he's like, I had an experience. I don't know how to describe it. He was talking about his vacation the same way that Jonesy, the doorman, when Don was drunk, asking him, "What did you see when you went to the other side?"
Yes, yes.
He kind of had that same reaction of like, "I don't know how to explain it. I don't want to talk about it."
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And I mean, usually when people die and then are revived, they do have like an out of body experience or whatever as well. So yeah, that all definitely wrapped in there. But yeah, no, I mean, I think that's all I had that I wanted to talk about.
The only other thing I wanted to mention that was just like this episode was depressing, or at least grim as far as showing what might come for these people. But the thing that made me the saddest was the headline that Don read in the newspaper as he was walking back into his apartment after sleeping with the doctor's wife, he read a headline that said something like, America bids adieu to a violent year, snow falls, something like that. Mm-hmm. And as we know, it's the beginning of 1968, which is going to be just about the worst year in the 60s for these characters.
Yeah.
It's going to be absolutely chaotic with Martin Luther King's assassination, RFK's assassination, and there's about to be a shit ton of soldiers killed in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Like, most of them are going to be killed in this year, and there's just going to be riots and anarchy across the United States, especially in New York in 1968. So it was just kind of depressing to see a headline like that of just saying, like, just the newspaper saying, oh, I hope things are going to be okay this year, and they're just so not going to be okay.
Yeah, yeah, no, I mean, the new year starts with a really calm and pretty scene, and people are hoping that that's how the new year will continue on, but clearly they're going to be in for a rude awakening.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, I don't know, I guess maybe you've convinced me a little bit that this episode was a little better than I originally thought it was.
That's all I ever want to do when it comes to Mad Men.
There you go. I mean, usually, you know, I love the Mad Men, so that's why it was a little surprising that I felt this one wasn't up to snuff, I suppose, but I'll just have to rewatch it, you know?
Well, that's what I was going to say. I don't know if I mentioned this last year in the podcast, I watch every episode twice,
mm-hmm.
because the first time I watched it, I was holding much of the opinion that you had on a lot of this stuff. I was just like, the scene we were just talking about with the doorman,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't understand what the hell just happened. But it's when I watch it again that I see what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, ah, damn it, this just show moves so fast.
Yeah, I mean, clearly Mad Men is something that you need to almost kind of watch multiple times before you can really form really good opinions on it, but unfortunately I can't spend like 4 hours watching Mad Men you know, in the first couple days of the week, so
that's one benefit of being unemployed.
Well, no, we'll get to that another day.
Yeah, you should quit your job so you can watch shows more than once.
Well, I mean, my job is very temporary, and unfortunately it's in the cycle now where I'm back on, so
yeah.
And plus, I have to watch a lot of crappy shows for the entertainment blog I write for, so that doesn't help. In any case, we'll definitely have to check out your little co-star role in The X's.
Yeah, I'll let you know when it's coming up. It'll be June, I think.
And yeah, we'll be coming back with you guys next week with another Game of Thrones and Mad Men pod.
Bag it up!
Mm-hmm.